Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I am your host, Graham Culbertson, and this is another in the series I'm doing this year for radicalism in the American Revolution. And I'm here today to talk to Mark Peterson about his new book on the U.S. Constitution. So, Mark, if you could introduce yourself, tell the listeners who you are, and then tell them a bit about this book and how you came to write it.
Okay, well, thank you, Graham, for inviting me on your podcast. My name is Mark Peterson, and I teach American history at Yale University. And the book, The Making and Breaking of the American Constitution, was a long time in coming. I've been teaching courses on the American Constitution for decades now, and really, in some ways, the origin story for the book came in the 1990s, in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, when I was particularly struck by the degree of American triumphalism about that outcome and the utter lack of any public recognition of the way that the Cold War had done damage to the United States, as all wars do damage to the countries who fight them, regardless of the outcome. And in particular, I was struck by what I saw as the gap between the sort of mythic or official history of the United States and of its constitution, of the kind of government it was supposed to have, and the actuality of the kind of state that the United States had become with the Cold War as a major feature in that development. And so over time, the fact of the remarkable distance, as I could see it, between the 18th century written Constitution of the United States, what the actual government of the United States was, and what the land and people of the country had become over two plus centuries, seemed to call out for attention. And yet I wasn't seeing anybody paying attention to these questions, and that the constitutional historians in the law schools and the courts and all were obsessed with the internal structure of this 4,500 word document from several centuries ago, and not at all with its relationship to the world that we live in. So in effect, what I've done is to write a social history of American constitutionalism, and one that insists that constitutions are not simply written documents, not just words on paper, but rather relationships among the land and people of a country, a polity, whatever, their frame of government, which includes all kinds of, you know, unwritten, customary, informal, evolutionary features, and finally, the written documents that attempt to empower, describe, limit, explain them, right? And so by taking that relationship, rather than just a written text at the focus, I was able to, you know, kind of stretch out and tell the long story going way back into the English Middle Ages of how American constitutionalism comes to be, what its aims have been, and in a sense, how we have come to the place we are today in the dark days of the early 21st century.
Okay, that's fantastic. Before we go any further, I just want to say to you and the listeners, a neighbor is taking an oak tree down right now. And I use a microphone that's pretty good about not picking up external noise. So I don't think we're going to hear it. But I mean, man, there could be a big crash or something at any moment. So, okay. And I mean, I can hear chainsaws constantly. So we'll just see how much destruction there is in the background. Having said that, you know, I think this book is fantastic. I mean, I loved it, actually. And it does strike me as a truly radical document because, and this has come up in a lot of my recent conversations, especially my recent conversation with the historian of the Roman Empire, Anthony Caldelis, of just the people who study law and politics, at least for the past, 100 years or so, seem to take an almost like an engineering approach. They are concerned with fixing this machine. I mean, really more like a computer science approach, like a computer science engineering approach. And so they're obsessed with this document, the U.S. Mm-hmm. Constitution, and it is baffling that they care so much about this document. And it just leads to these statements that outrage me, where someone says something is unconstitutional and you almost want that the U in unconstitutional to be capitalized, as if there's a thing called the Constitution and we know what it is, and some things violate it and other things don't. And the example I always use for this is, 5 years ago, it was clear that making abortion illegal was unconstitutional. And now it's clear that making abortion illegal is constitutional. And if you have a social historical understanding of the Constitution, you can actually make sense of this, that it was lowercase u unconstitutional 5 years ago and lowercase c constitutional now, because the Constitution is this thing that is much more than just a document and has so many things going into it. But the same people who, this capital U or capital C sense of unconstitutional or constitutional is very hard to square with the lived reality. And when I found, I'm going to let you talk a second. Mm-hmm. I just have so many thoughts about this. When I found your reference in your book to James Madison, writer of the Constitution, the person who created this sacred text, saying that, there are just certain constitutional rules are just parchment barriers. They're not worth the paper they're printed on. If someone said that right now, they would be accused of, desecrating the memory of the great James Madison. But it was James mm-hmm. Madison who said that the paper part is all, at best, part of the story of what a constitution is.
Right. Well, this is exactly why I wanted to bring readers' attentions back to an understanding of American constitutionalism as broader than, let's just call it, textualism for the mm-hmm. moment, right? One of the chapters early in the book begins with a quotation from Benjamin Rush of Philadelphia, who was a doctor, who was a leader of the resistance movement in the 1760s and 70s, an important political figure in Pennsylvania politics. And this is during the crisis over the Tea Act in 1773, in which colonists are trying to figure out how to respond to the monopoly that Parliament has given to the East India Company to distribute tea in America and therefore enforce the tax in the Tea Act. And Benjamin Rush says in a speech to his listeners something along the lines of, remember your ancestors and think of your posterity, because this struggle will fix the Constitution forever. Now, he's not talking about a written document, right? He's talking about the complex constitutional relationship between Britain's constitution, the colony's own charters and structures of government that they've had for more than a century, or nearly a century in Pennsylvania's case, and finally, the balance of power and custom and authority that, in this case, will decide whether the colonists get to legislate for themselves on taxation, or whether Parliament has the ultimate power to enforce taxation regardless of what the colonies want. And what he's saying is that if Pennsylvanians give in and accept the distribution of tea, then they're giving in to Parliament's power to tax them now and forever. Right? It has nothing to do with written documents. It has to do with a deep understanding of the distribution of power in this society and how it's going to work in the future if this precedent is set. Right? So that's a perfectly adequate And in fact, historically, a prominent definition of what a constitution is and how it works, you know, 20 some or 15 some years before Philadelphia in 1787. And so in large part, one of the purposes of this book is to get Americans today to think in similar terms, to realize that we can be constitution makers too, that it's not the privilege and the property of the Supreme Court or of law schools or whatever to determine, as you say, what is and isn't constitutional, but for Americans to make the constitution they want, we want and need in our world today.
Yeah, and I just think that this has been totally lost, and it is. I mean, I want to call it legalism, essentially. So I'm thinking, you know, as we're recording, I'm not quite sure this episode will come out, but as we're recording, there continues to be debates about whether the war in Iran or the military operation against Iran has or has not lasted for 60 days and does or does not require congressional approval. And this is a paper barrier, a parchment barrier. Every president essentially has ignored this 60-day thing. And it would be pretty easy for Congress and or the people to assert their power over U.S. military imperialism if they wanted to, if we wanted to. And one option, the probably the true option, is neither Congress nor the American people want to devote time and energy to ending American imperialism abroad. But the other option is that people just think it's not in their hands. I mean, you know, Congress mm-hmm. passed this law and Congress has to enforce it. And what are we going to do about it? And if the president is going to do lots of wars, well, you know, I think there's things in the Constitution that says the president's in charge of the military. So we're just... oh, well, and that's not what they thought in the 18th and early 19th century. Just, oh, well, it's what's on the piece of paper, so we don't get to do anything about it.
Right. It's also not what they thought in 1972. Right? I mean, but at the same time, it's essential to understand that the material and social circumstances of our lives play a huge part in that. And in 1972, there was a national draft where, you know, young men between the ages of 18 and whatever were looking at the fate of being sent to Vietnam, right? And that's not the case today. And it hasn't been the case in this country for a long time. You know, the ratio between human power and technical power and war making has so shifted, and the way the United States conducts war has so shifted that those kinds of concerns have been eliminated, and so the likelihood of mass protest is much diminished, right? And so you're correct that if we're going to expect some kind of large-scale public outcry and the people's representatives in Congress, you know, voicing that, then we have to think about ways in which, you know, the concerns of ordinary Americans turn in this direction and shape the conversation.
Yeah, and this will bring me back to something that I bring up often in this podcast, which is, you know, David Graeber has this essay about constituent power, which essentially says, you know, the people are allowed to rise up at any moment, overthrow the government, and form a new constitution. How do you know that it was the people rising up instead of dissidents or rebels? Well, the answer is that they won. So mm-hmm. if it's Shay's Rebellion or if it's the Whiskey Rebellion, it's not the people. Those were dissidents and rebels. But if it's the American Revolution, it was the people. And so this sense that the Constitution is supposed to come from this democratic source of sovereignty. And when that democratic source of sovereignty tends to express itself with mob action and violence, and then the new constitution formed out of violence is legitimate according to the keepers of the Constitution, as long as they were able to form a new constitution. And if they weren't able to form a new constitution, then their mob action or their violence or their revolt is illegitimate. And okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm going to roll this back a little bit because I need to stop you on Shay's Rebellion. I've written a lot about this, not in this book, but in my previous book on Boston. And I'm not sure I'd use exactly the same terminology, but in fact, I wouldn't even call it Shay's Rebellion, because that's the name that its opponents gave it.
Yes.
It was the Massachusetts Regulation, right? And I would argue that it was the people of Massachusetts. In large scale, ordinary farm families, not necessarily poor ones. In fact, many of the reason that its opponents called it Shay's Rebellion was because Shay's was the opponent's poster child. He was poor. He was not a major figure. But a lot of the leaders of Shay's Rebellion were major figures in their town, large landowners, in some cases the largest landowner in their town. And what they lacked was cash, was hard silver money. And the problem with the legislation that prompted Shay's Rebellion was that it required the payment of steep taxes in silver that people didn't have, even though they had enough wealth to pay the tax. And because they didn't have the silver, their farms were being foreclosed upon in courts. And so people rise up and oppose that, and there's a little bit of violence involved. And eventually the state calls out a state militia to put it down. But the aftermath of Shay's Rebellion was that the people of Massachusetts en masse voted out the sitting governor, voted in a new legislature, and they changed the laws, repealing the requirement of silver payment and scaling down the taxation. So it was actually a quite successful out-of-doors political action that got the state government to, you know, get out of this logjam and change its directions in a way that then never happened again in Massachusetts, right? So I this is the kind of thing I really draw attention to in this book, the way in which the specific determinations shape these outcomes in all kinds of ways. And so what I'm saying is that, you know, within the traditions of the 18th century that you just raised, Shay's Rebellion was a legitimate expression of ordinary people's participation in government at the time.
Yes, I just want to say we're in complete agreement on that.
Yeah.
If there were a new Shay's Rebellion right now, it would be just described as unconstitutional immediately. It would be described as is a threat to our values, our polity, our American way of life, our very constitution. But what this book reveals is that, you know, citizen uprisings was in fact a major part of the U.S. Constitution for a certain portion of its existence. I would guess that the Civil War is probably the biggest. Shay's Rebellion is often explained as the explanation for why we have a constitution. I guess briefly, before we go on this, I do want to do an entire episode on Shay's Rebellion at some point in this series, but I haven't gotten very far in that planning. I did discover that Thomas Jefferson described it as anarchy. So that's a useful thing for my purposes.
The interesting thing about what I will insist on calling the Massachusetts Regulation was that the farther away you were from it, the more frightening it seemed. Right. And so you referred to James Madison. Yes, people like Madison thought that this was the sign that Republican government in the states was breaking down. Right. But that's generally not what the people of Massachusetts thought about this, right? That in fact, in the end, Republican government worked. And so, yes, it was used as a pretext for calling the Constitutional Convention by certain people in certain ways, but it's not as if that's like a determinative answer to what's going on in 1787.
Yeah, and I have no objection to the Massachusetts Rebellion. the Massachusetts regulation, let's say, that fits well, you know, with the regulators in North Carolina as well. I have no objection to that being to that being constitutional. But you will find that the defenders of the Constitution today will view it as the kind of thing that, quote, the Constitution was written to prevent from happening.
Yeah, no, that's a common story that's told. Yeah.
Okay, so I want to get into the narrative of your book itself, because it, I found it very useful for my thinking. So there's something that I've struggled with really for my entire career, which is that, you know, you want to be on the side of democracy. I want to be on the side of democracy. And a lot of the two figures most associated with democracy in the first decades of the United States, the two, you know, in Hofstadter's book figures are Jefferson and Jackson. And you don't want to be on the side of Jefferson and Jackson, because they're both slaveholders and imperialists. And something I've tried to square over time, and your book helped me make sense of it, and you can tell me if I've got this wrong, is that essentially the U.S. Constitution, the new government, and really the forces unleashed by Jefferson and Jackson was a sort of settler, colonialist, imperialist democracy. And that's what the Constitution really did in the first decades of its life. They adopted a Roman model. They even used the name Legion for a conquering army. And the goal of that conquering army, the Romans did a combination of settling people who were already Romans into the lands they had conquered, and also inviting the people who had been conquered to become Romans. The people in the United States did not do this. They only settled Americans, white descendants of Europeans, or primarily settled. There's also the slave states, which we can leave out for now. But in the northern part of the Western states, the goal of the Constitution was to create a government that could defeat and either relocate or exterminate the Indians who had been offered protection by King George III. So they had to get rid of King George III because he was going to prevent this democratic imperialism. And then the goal was to create, you know, in a sort of Jeffersonian or Jacksonian way, smallholding farmers who could then join the body politic in the form of states. And so it's something that can be celebrated and is celebrated by people like Voltairine de Cleyre, who's an anarchist writer in the 19th century, as something that's actually democratic. And the Constitution therefore becomes an instrument of democracy. But it's an institution of democracy that is also premised on imperialism and genocide. And that's why you get people like John Quincy Adams is against democracy in certain ways. But part of that is that he's trying to restrain the rapacious thirst for land that the democratic forces unfold. So that was my reading, combining work I've done for the past decade plus your book, and I just wanted to throw it out at you and see what you thought.
Yeah, well, there's a lot in what you say. One thing to know is that I you can read the book and you won't find me using the phrase settler colonialism or the word genocide. In part because, not that they're wrong exactly, but because they are anachronistic. They're later constructions put back on earlier times. And I tend to see their use in scholarship often as a substitute for clear description, analysis, and thinking about what's happening. Right? They tend to schematize. Mm-hmm. And you could say the same thing for the way in which, over the centuries, the relationship has been built up between Jefferson and democracy, right? Again, that was Jeffersonian propaganda, right? That was Jeffersonians trying to denigrate their political opponents in this period, who were largely New Englanders, who were far more democratic than the oligarchs of Virginia, which Jefferson most definitely was. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, I would say you can't temporarily set aside the South, the plantation world, the slave complex in telling this story, right? As appealing as that might be. So what I'm saying is that, yes, the former colonies as independent states absolutely pick up the same colonizing project that Britain had begun and then pursued for a century and a half before the revolution. But what they do in, you know, seizing this project for themselves is to realign the structures of constitutional thinking and government thinking to a certain extent in the way that you describe, right? By placing control over the expansionist project in the hands of a much more egalitarian society. There are no aristocrats by, you know, title and birth in North America. There's no monarchy. But by no means does the revolution do away with the inequalities of power and wealth across the United States, or the huge disparity among the states in the way they think about government and its structure. So it's the case that in the way that the aspirations for the transformation of the West are laid out, there is most definitely a hope for a kind of smallholder development. But at the same time, they can never bring themselves to eliminate the possibility, which they could well have done, of large-scale land speculation, mm-hmm. of big landowners and the like. And part of the reason that they don't do that is the fact that the George Washingtons and Thomas Jeffersons and James Madisons of this world were the large-scale land speculators and were, you know, plantation oligarchs. And so it's always this tension in the American expansionist project between aspirations for an egalitarian smallholder society, which is what New England was, right? Mm-hmm. And the capacity to allow, you know, the enormous development of the plantation complex, which of course happens as well, right? So I don't try to pull, you know, those apart or say that one of them is the American constitutional project or whatever. They're both deeply embedded in it. The thing that I really want to emphasize is that I'm trying to draw attention to the fact of what a peculiar nation state the United States was at its beginnings. That is, your Roman analogy is interesting to a point, but Rome, you know, as it shifts from republic to empire and begins its conquests of Gaul and Britain and Persia and all that sort of thing, it was already a large, powerful, centralized state, right? And the thing about the United States at its origins, when the Treaty of Paris grants it autonomy, independence, and grants it this enormous territory to its west, out to the Mississippi, territory it had not conquered, right? Territory where its citizens did not live, Indian country. The United States at that time had no assets, none whatsoever, and had no power to raise them, no taxation power. And the states themselves, although they had taxation power, also were extremely limited in wealth and assets and were suffering from the debt that they owed for the fighting of the Revolutionary War. So what's so distinctive about the United States in 1787, as it is writing a second constitution to empower the national government in new ways, is that the whole project is speculative, right? They are trying to figure out how to conduct this transformative colonization project over this huge territory that they've been granted, territory that many of them think is going to be their downfall, right? Just as it had been Britain's in the preceding decades, right? I have quotations in the book of people saying, yeah, the only reason the British gave us so much land in the treaty is that they expect it will ruin us, right? That we're not going to be able to do it. And so I'm really trying to draw attention to the way in which the United States Constitution was crafted among all these widely varied states to conduct this project, which was kind of the one thing that they could all agree on, and yet preserved the huge variance among them as to the kinds of society they are, right? So I sort of push back against the general smallholder idea, because that's not really what the United States as a whole was in 1787. And there's no one powerful enough in this coalition saying, yeah, we're all going to do it this one way, right? Instead, you get this unfolding of a very conflicted, very disparate nation across this project once the Constitution is in place.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I want to say briefly, the Roman comparison is in part mine, but it's even more theirs. They call it the Society of Cincinnatus, and they call this army the Legion because they're thinking of Caesar conquering Gaul.
Let me remind your listeners that the actual Cincinnatus was a smallholder. He was an owner of 4 acres, whereas the actual the symbolic Cincinnatus, George Washington, you know, owned more than 60,000 acres, right? And that difference is immense in thinking about the range of ways that people were imagining how this project would go.
Well, I mean, I guess the other thing is just to extend this. I mean, I agree with everything you said in terms of pushing back against this sense is that this is very broad. There's a million, we can identify a million different factions, but I'm roughly inclined to think there's 3 factions, the small northern commercial and eventually industrialist factors, which are the ones that de Tocqueville warns are going to be the potential source of oligarchy, the small holding farmers, and the southern oligarchy. And then this is a very broad reading, is the Civil War is fought as an alliance of the smallholders and the northern business and industrial interests against the southern oligarchy. But in the post-Civil War dispensation, the Republican Party is dominated by these northern interests, and the southern oligarchy isn't really smashed, and it's the smallholders who are the big losers. And when this kind of coalition is reformed, it's reformed in the same sense it would have been formed in Europe. It's a socialist movement. It's a progressive movement. It looks to the national government created in the Civil War to deliver the welfare state, whereas you describe, talking about anachronism, you describe the parceling out of the land to potential farmers as a welfare state for its inhabitants, although you also point out that the big land speculators are always preventing it from becoming the agrarian smallholding dream that we find described in Jefferson and Thomas Paine, and then Proudhon is the big socialist advocate for this thing in Europe. So again, I'm throwing out a bunch of stuff, leaping over time. Some of it's anachronistic. You can pick up any of it you want, or we can move on to a couple more parts of the book, however you would like.
Well, again, I would add something to this discussion that is distinctive to the United States. And there's this curious thing. Anytime, especially an American historian, starts talking about the ways in which the United States is different from, let's say, European countries that some people want to compare them to, the instantly someone says, "Oh, you're being exceptionalist," right? And I don't think that's true. Exceptionalist means somehow not subject to the same rules of history, right? That other places are, and that's not what I'm saying. But I am trying to draw attention to how important it is to understanding 19th century America that the natural landscape and environment of North America radically changes when you move east to west and hit the 100th meridian, right? because east of the 100th meridian is where there's rainfall, is where there's water, great lakes, rivers, etc. And so what I described as a kind of proto-welfare state, knowing full well the anachronism of the term.
Yes, of course.
What that meant was that all the United States government needed to do to encourage its booming population to expand westward was to do the work of what was commonly called clearing Indian title to the land, which sometimes meant military violence, actually more often meant purchase. Not that these purchases were always done in fair or non-coercive ways, but nonetheless, the removal of indigenous claims and indigenous population from the land. And then once that was done, it took no effort from the national government for colonizers, settlers to move there, right? And the growth and expansion of the American population from east of the Appalachians out to the Mississippi and beyond is extraordinary, right? It's a story in human population history that has few equals anywhere. But then around 1870, once the tier of states immediately west of the Mississippi have become part of the Union, it stops, right? Because the land changes so dramatically that ordinary farmers literally cannot subsist in places where there isn't enough rainfall, where there's no infrastructure, and where there isn't money to be made in commercial farming that will encourage people to go out there. And so for that reason, although the numbers have changed dramatically, the overall population map of the United States today looks just about like it did in 1870, if you figure in the invention of air conditioning as the other factor in this. And so what that meant was that from that point forward, the continuation of the Continental Project, expansion farther into the West, and the development of places like that required the federal government to step in, raise and spend resources, use its power in ways it had never done before, right? And so even the Homestead Act passed during the Civil War, in which the federal government is going to give away land for free to anyone who will go and settle on it, it doesn't work, right? People don't move to these territories even with free land. And so what it requires is that the federal government give away land and spend money on railroads and dams and all of this high-level, often mining-driven in industrial scale development that no private individual can do, so that it transforms the West into something like the sort of colonizing model of the eastern part of the United States. But that even more undermines the possibility for a kind of, if you want to call it Jeffersonian, I just as soon call it a New England style, small scale, independent, you know, landowner, farmer, republic, because the dominant factors in the West become then the giant railroads, the massive farming industries that you get in places like California, the mines, the dams, all of those kinds of things, right? And so in all of those ways, by the end of the 19th century, the United States has already drifted very far from the kind of country that is imagined in the agrarian world of 1787. So you're absolutely right that at that point then, lots of Americans from many different walks of life, from rural farmers to, you know, industrial workers in the cities to, you know, progressive thinkers, are realizing the United States Constitution, actually the written Constitution, doesn't describe or empower the government of the kind of country the United States has become anymore. And so at that point, the sort of last great internal reform movement to the Constitution begins, attempts to amend it in ways that will change those things. And those are designed to address the ways in which the country, the people and the land have become a different thing than a century earlier.
Yeah, this was the only thing that I wanted to make sure we hit next. I mean, I guess, let me just say, since it's come up over and over again, I truly detest Thomas Jefferson Students used to joke that my American Studies class was just called it why Culbertson hates Jefferson. But he has become, and we should probably replace him with Paine, but I haven't read enough Paine. He has become the spokesperson for this way of American life, even though you're absolutely right. It's New England where that way of life actually flourishes, and Jefferson himself was in most ways, or in many ways, an enemy of that. The other thing, just briefly, because we're almost done, because we started with the end of the book, and then you just got to the final bit that we hadn't discussed before the end, is this does all break down because there is no way to make Idaho or Arizona into a state that makes sense in a way that you are able to make Minnesota into a state that makes a little more sense than, especially Ohio, of course, is like you can make Ohio into a state that's very similar to North Carolina or Virginia because of the land and the water. And then the biggest part of the crisis, or a major part of the crisis that we're experiencing right now, is that we have this, you know, more than 200-year-old document that is being treated like it is sacred, and being treated like the Constitution is that piece of paper. The other problem, of course, is, you know, the U.S. government and business interests and the just amazing ability to, as you say, build dams and railroads has made Arizona a populous state that makes sense. It makes sense in the older constitutional arrangement. It's made California a state that makes no sense in the old constitutional arrangement, because it outstrips, I would say, even Virginia in terms of its, you know, the old Virginia in terms of its lack of parity with its neighbors. And then California is so close to a place like Wyoming or Montana, which are probably further away from today's California than the old Vermont was from the old Virginia. And a constitution that was designed to balance all these things can just no longer come anywhere near to balancing them.
Well, let me address this, because these are important things, and it brings me back to Jefferson. So I sympathize with your anti-Jeffersonianism, but I sort of think of him as a tragic figure in that he was not of his own choosing, you know, the heir to old Virginia's tobacco large-scale plantation system, right? It's the world he's born into. And as, you know, a serious student, you know, educated in the doctrines of the Enlightenment, he comes to, you know, firm commitment to those principles, right? And spells them out in the Declaration and, you know, in Virginia's Statute of Religious Freedom, right? It's not that he doesn't believe these, but he's torn, right? I mean, to actually live out in his own life and in the larger world of Virginia and the United States, a full belief in those principles he was educated in, in a sense, would have required him to shoot himself in both feet, right? Could he have freed his slaves though he wanted to? Well, you might think yes, but he couldn't free his slaves any more than I can free my house from the mortgage on it, right? I can't just say, away you go, house, and live a happy life. He was in debt, right? The whole structure of the world that he lived in was built on a system that he was born into and could not undo himself. Right. And so a lot of his hypocrisy, a lot of his double dealing was kind of baked in to the world that he lived in. It isn't to excuse him so much as just to explain him. But I will say that he is in many ways the inadvertent culprit that gives us Idaho. describe this in the book. That is, one of the ideals of the Constitution was to correct that very inequality among the states that the United States was born with, right? No one planned for Rhode Island and Delaware to be in an equal confederation with Virginia, but the differences between them were absurd. And so the Constitution's process of transforming the land that was not yet states into states was actually deliberately designed so that, you know, they couldn't change Rhode Island, but they could make sure that all of the new states that were added to the Union would be, as you say, like Ohio, relatively the same size, so that over time, the bizarre inequalities in something like the Senate, it would get less and less troublesome. And they were very successful in doing that out to the 100th meridian, right? If you look at all of the states west of the Mississippi, there's a remarkable similarity to the area of each of them. And because this was an agrarian world, once they filled up with population, the idea would they would all be relatively equal in wealth and power in that sense. And it's the desert west that changes all of that, right? It and the unwillingness of Congress to stop playing the game of using the admission of new states as a way to guarantee your side's or your party's votes in the future of the national political contest. And Jefferson was more responsible than anyone else for that becoming the game of 19th century American politics by not standing up for his own principles that you needed amendments to the Constitution to admit new states out of foreign territory, right? If you had required that, then you would have had the buy-in from all of the states every time a new one was admitted, and you couldn't have done that politicking game of slave states versus free states that drove the U.S. into the Civil War, or the famous Omnibus Bill of 1889-90 that admitted six states to the Union, right? Two Dakotas, Montana, Wyoming, right? All so that the Republicans could get more Senate seats, right? Not because those places had enough people or wealth or settlement to actually qualify as states in the Union compared to the Eastern one. So, you know, after most of a century of equalizing the states and eliminating things like the distorting problem of the Senate, the United States then backtracked afterwards and created all of these states that, you know, I asked my students, it's a trick question. When did Wyoming develop a large enough population to deserve even one representative in the U.S. Congress? And the answer is, of course, never, right? Wyoming has never had enough people to equal the average number of people that that one representative in Congress represents. And so it was this sort of desperate failure to sustain the ideals of the original Constitution itself in the West that is at the root of this problem that's going to get worse and worse and worse over time, the one that you mentioned, the California versus Wyoming problem.
I mean, no offense to any listeners in the Dakotas, but it, precisely as you say, they're still not ready to be states. I mean, just the state model has ceased to work over the past century or so.
And so this is why, you know, one of hundreds of reasons why, you know, veneration of this 18th century document and the way it has sort of baked in, or maybe better, frozen in, certain structures to our political lives, which make no sense in the world we live in today, means that, I kind of doubt that there's any possibility for systemic reform from within the rules of that system, right? And it's the case, and the book argues this, that every major constitutional intervention or transformation going all the way back to medieval England through the present, they happen unconstitutionally. They don't happen by the rules of the current system, because if the rules of the current system could handle the problem, then it wouldn't be a crisis, right? But constitutional crises tend to resolve themselves in new solutions that were not constitutional under the old order. And so ultimately, one of the prime reasons I wrote this book, it's the way I've been teaching this for years, is to encourage people now to start thinking about the kind of constitution they would like to have for this country going forward. Because it's always the case that when these crises come, the people who go into them with a plan, like that clever James Madison that you talked about, tend to do well, right? Tend to, you know, a plan tends to beat no plan every time. And so I wrote this book in large part to get Americans planning and thinking about a better constitution in that larger sense going forward.
Yeah, and another way of putting it, to bring it all the way back around, this is a perfect place to end, is that, you know, when you read the Declaration and when you read Jefferson, you know, in this famous statement about, you know, the tree of liberty and the the blood of patriots, there the willingness to find a new arrangement that works for the people and the place could be read as the actual U.S. Constitution, lowercase c. Yep. And the great enemy of the deeper, the truer Constitution is the capital C U.S. Constitution, that stupid piece of paper that gives Wyoming and California the same amount of power and lets the Supreme Court decide whether abortion or not is legal based on abstruse reasoning that no one understands.
Absolutely. That's what I say, that no matter what they fought about, and they fought like cats over everything in the Constitutional Convention, they all agreed that it was the right and the duty of a free people who believe that their old constitution is failing them to come up with a new one and a better one to suit the world that they lived in, right? That was absolutely fundamental groundwork. No one in Independence Hall in 1787 would have disagreed with that for one second, right? Even though a bunch of them refused to sign the one that they came up with, right? And I think that's as true today as it was then, and that Americans need to get on the case.
Fantastic. I couldn't have ended up anywhere better. Thank you so much, Mark. Thank you for this conversation. And really, this book was really impressive. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Everyone should go out and read it.
Yes.